It is Saturday, October 25th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio in rainy California is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, traveler, and total space nerd. Hi, Ben.
I'm so happy it's raining right now.
I feel like I've got a real radio voice today, like a yeah. It's kind of crazy.
You're going fast today. Yeah. Well,
that's good because we've got lots of news. Let's talk about Apple first, shall we?
All right. Let's talk about Apple. So I've got two stories relating to Apple. First of all is just this is not really news for now, but the iPhone 6 that's come out has a barometer in it.
Yes, it does.
And there are a lot of Android phones that have a barometer. And there's an interesting story about...
Now, barometer is an air pressure detector, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's an interesting story about what we can do with... basically, a nation and a world with these mini barometers in people's pockets everywhere, right? I mean, this is... So, normally you would have weather stations, and you'd set up these weather stations with very accurate equipment and everything. But you can only set up a couple of them, right? So, in a particular area. And so, I remember looking... when I was a kid, I remember looking at the weather, and I had found a website where you could look at the individual weather stations and kind of... infer what the areas in between them were like.
Well, it's just kind of what happens, right? We kind of average the areas. And so if you've got one weather station in a microclimate area, it doesn't necessarily represent much of an area, right?
Yeah, like...
The more dense we have, the better idea we have on the weather. Yeah,
yeah, if there's one weather station in San Francisco...
yeah, right. Forget it.
There's just no way. Yeah. It's like 20, 30 degrees difference sometimes. So, or maybe more. I don't actually live in San Fran. But... So now everyone has these barometers in their pockets, and you can do a lot of interesting things with barometers. And one of the things that this one particular researcher is looking at is hurricane detection, like trying to use this data to figure out how likely or unlikely hurricanes are and in what way they will form.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And it's very much this... this distributed system is exactly what we need,
right?
Right.
Well,
we don't need individual.
Years ago about weather prediction is that because you can't get a sample of every atom on the planet, you can't detect it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The more sensors you have, the more a better picture you'll get. But in fact, without a complete picture, there'll still be a lack of ability to detect, especially as you get to understand the simplicity of chaos theory. It's actually not possible to detect it. But the more sensors you get, the better. And
that's
so
true.
This does make sense that if you could get everybody to contribute their barometer and location information, what a magical detection world we could have. But
yeah,
it's also
that's exactly the question is everybody's got these barometers in their pockets, and can you access that data? Is that okay to just go and accessing location, we can clearly understand why that wouldn't be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's anonymized, it's just kind of weird for someone to know where you are for you.
Well, I think it's great questions to answer as we have more and more detectors with us. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that though this is like a dedicated process, dedicated sensor for barometer, there's other ways to potentially detect barometer. And so this makes it easier and everything. And because it's a labeled sensor and you know that it can do this, that's a good thing, because the more you understand the complexity of the sensors in the stuff that you're carrying, the better understanding you have of how you're kind of advertising to the world what's going on for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just watching a DEFCON video, which I'm not linking to this show and everything on because I don't know if I could find it again, but it was basically about the radiation that our devices put out all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
The There's FCC regulations on electronic devices that have to not broadcast too much information. Anytime you throw electrons through something, it actually acts as an antenna, right? Because anytime electrical flow happens, you get a magnetic field around it.
So this is why sometimes if I touch my radio antenna, the signal changes.
Yeah,
because I'm becoming part of the antenna.
Yeah, and sensitive enough sensors can actually detect computers through houses and such. So
yeah, there's crazy stories.
There's a lot you can do with the noise you produce. Of course, people aren't aware of this, right? They think of a passive thing as a passive thing, but it's not. So I think the better people understand the complexity of the sensors that they're carrying around, the more we have a public discourse, the better we figure out how our society is going to deal with it. So
yeah,
it's kinda cool.
So this article
was one story of like 20 we have today. We better move along.
Well, actually, I have a good segue into the next,
okay, go ahead.
The other Apple one I have, which is, so this guy is saying Google could do this because they're Android phones and they could just pre-install the code to transmit the data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you could piggyback onto a popular app like the Weather Channel app or something like that. But this is exactly the question that my next story is talking about. So Apple OS 10, which is actually really confusing to type, because you want to type it with an X, but then you want to type 10.10, so you type 3.10s. Anyway, it's called Yosemite, and it's the latest version of OS 10 on your Mac. And so some people have been saying, it's actually sending a good amount of data back to Apple, even when you say don't. Even when you turn all of your privacy settings off and everything. So there's actually a GitHub repository. GitHub is a place where people can put up code for other people to see. And so there's actually this GitHub repository filled with the data set that was transmitted when this person was testing this, right, on their machine. And so they actually have taken all the data that got sent to Apple that they could intercept and put it online for people to see and like,
cool.
is it okay that they're sending emails now, I'm registering with and that
so
kind of stuff?
I saw a story like this when Yosemite was still in beta, and beta are very different, right? One of the things we talk about beta is not really ready for prime time, but sometimes it really represents what the software will be, except that in a beta process, you accept some terms and conditions that are about the testing of the software. It's the whole point of a mass release of a beta,
because
you can see it at scale.
So so as a beta tester, I'm saying, all right, you can collect my information because I'm helping you find bugs.
Yeah, so it's possible this Yosemite phone home thing could be based off of information in a beta release, and therefore
maybe,
so I'm sure the GitHub repo
forgot to turn it off or something.
Well, no, I wouldn't say turn it off, but it's possible that the person was testing and happened to be a beta user, and maybe they who knows. In any case,
I don't think so.
Okay, go.
Here's one of the examples.
Yes.
So instead of using Google or Bing or whatever for searches, some people use DuckDuckGo. And so if you switch Safari, the default web browser on OS X, if you switch the search engine to DuckDuckGo and then you enter a search term, it sends it off to DuckDuckGo and it sends that search term off to Apple.
Oh, odd.
Yeah. So it's not only innocuous seeming things.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't seem very justifiable to me.
Well, there's possibly a justifiable, right? I mean, if you want your local predictive search results to, in the operating system, be better, you want to know what people are searching.
No, but so this person turned off Spotlight. The Spotlight auto.
So we're getting a little nerdy about this, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
That's what we do sometimes.
It's
Yosemite. First, I don't know if you specified. Yosemite is the newest version of OS 10. Uh-huh. We mentioned it last week. It's 10.10.10. And, right? X.10.10. And of course, now we're seeing that it's doing
some
things.
That's what I was saying. It's just 10.10. There aren't three tens.
Yeah,
just
people
three
say OS X 10.10. They say it that way.
No, so people say OS 10, but people write OS X.
Okay, let's move on. So,
anyway.
So speaking of phoning home, this is actually kind of the inverse of that. Have you heard about this whole Horizon header advertising thing? It's pretty nasty.
Verizon. Okay.
So Verizon is okay. So every time you do a web request, your browser is basically sending a package of information to another machine, right? So let's say geekspeak.org. You send a get geekspeak.org/episode today, right, whatever. And then in that request, it also says things like, I'm compatible with these browsers. These are my cookies that you've set for me before. This is the operating system I'm on.
Mm-hmm.
This is my IP address. There's all this packet information that goes along with it. This in HTTP is called headers. And that header information is controlled by your browser and your operating system. That's what builds it up. And that information is kind of part of the original packet. and totally transparent in HTTP, which is still a majority of internet traffic, I believe.
So anyone who happened to be in the middle of this request could just reach out and grab it.
Yeah. Well, so telcos are in the middle of that. If you're on a Verizon network, a phone or home Verizon ISP plan, Verizon has been adding header information to that request, their own. And it's X-UIDH is the name of the header, and then it looks like a long hash of some sort.
Now, so you're saying that if my computer sends off a header through the Verizon network,
yes.
Verizon is adding additional information
yes.
to that header?
Yes, which means that the website that receives it, they're doing this most likely because of a patent they filed a while ago. So this is how it works, and it's kind of creepy. Now, this is a wonderful article breakdown from Jonathan Meyer. He's a computer scientist and a lawyer mm-hmm. at Stanford, and he's basically been inspecting it and then looking at old marketing materials and related patents that Verizon has filed to see what it might be that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they are adding this unique identifying header to all web traffic they can. That's HTTP traffic that goes through their network.
So not encrypted stuff, not like
right.
Gmail or Bank of America or any of those.
Right. So the device sends a request, an HTTP request to like geekspeak.org, goes through Verizon. In Verizon, they inject this thing, and at the destination website, like geekspeak.org, or any website, you could get this header. Then with that header, it's a unique identifier for that request, for that session or request. Then you could take that same header, and it's going to be on all traffic you get, right? So if you advertise with something, the advertiser would also see this header. And then the advertiser can take that hash and they can send a request to Verizon saying, can you give me information on this user? And Verizon, with some money attached, and Verizon will then take and send some information to the advertiser. The advertiser will then return the ad. So it's a way... Yeah. The advertiser doesn't know who you are, but they know the metrics they want to pay Verizon to tell them.
So here's a question. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but... So if I'm sending off all these different requests to different websites,
yeah.
that unique identifier, is it going to be the same?
No, I think it's unique per website.
Per web, okay.
Yeah, it's an HTTP header. It's is a temporary ID hashed or hashed with a key. So
okay.
I don't think it is...
So it's a bunch of numbers that somehow represents
right. so
this
the
particular
web,
request.
Here's the point is the website that you're actually visiting and the advertiser, because they're different domains, they're going to get a different header,
mm-hmm.
and they can't connect them. But they could connect them other ways, right? By page URLs.
But this is an
URLs.
Easier
But the point
way.
Is that Verizon's the middleman that gets the money from the advertiser to tell them that, oh, this person lives in Nebraska, but they're actually currently in Florida, right? Like information that the telco knows about you that's pretty extensive.
But, I mean, so there are reasons why advertisers and the website you're visiting are different domains
yes.
and act different. Like, this separation
Well, that's the thing is this is another level that hasn't happened in advertising before.
Yeah, yeah, but it feels to me almost like this separation exists for some sort of security reason.
Well, yeah, we talked about it for years, right? Cross-domain scripting and
exactly.
And
so what they're doing
cookies
is
being unique per domain.
They're circumventing
yeah.
a
more than that though. The Verizon company, if they took a survey on you, know that you like apples. I mean, whatever Verizon potentially knows about you.
Which
no, I
apples?
Mean apples like you eat, delicious like Macintosh apples. Wait, this
okay.
is confusing.
Mm.
Let's move on, shall we?
Not as much a fan of the Macintoshes, but
well, we talked.
Sweet Deliciouses are amazing. Sweet
really?
Delici? Sweet Deliciouses.
Yeah, I stopped eating apples like 3 years ago. Just replaced it with bacon. Let's move on.
What?
Google has a new app.
You're just going to leave it hanging at that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, Google actually recently released a new app. This was just a couple days ago. This is actually on Wednesday they released it, and it's called Inbox, and they say years in the making, blah, blah, blah. So...
I'll install it now. Go on.
First, well, if you can, you yeah. need you need an invite. Now, first of all, why they have to go name it Inbox? But
well, Apple calls theirs Mail, right? Is it an email client?
It is not.
Is it
kind
for Android?
Of. It's kind
what,
of.
What is it for? And it's mobile.
It's kind of an email client. So, from what I've read and from what I can infer from not having seen the app because it's in beta and invite only. From what I can tell, it goes through your email, and it does something similar to what Google Now does, which is it figures out, for example, it'll figure out that you have a flight coming up, and it'll push that to you, to the Inbox app. Now I have to stop saying it'll push it to your inbox. It'll push it to the Inbox app, and then that app will show it to you in a particular way, in almost like a Google Keep kind of way or a to-do app kind of way where you could take that notification, you could snooze it, you could say, you know, I don't want to deal with this now, but I do want to see this tomorrow morning or something like that. So it kind of gives you almost, this is kind of a geeky way to put it, but it's almost like a meta inbox where you can send things
like
away
an extension,
and they'll come back.
It sounds to me like an extension of Google Now, like a feature set.
Extension of Google Now /
service.
Gmail, kind of.
Well, I mean, Google Now is already scanning the inbox, your email inbox. Oh, man, what a horrible name.
I guess
that's all we've got right now. We know anything about the name. We only know about the name, really. And
well,
we hate the name. That's
great. The name iPad was worse. But
hey, let's,
now people don't even give it a second thought.
Let's talk more about Google, maybe these USB stuff, security things. Talk a little bit more about some fun records, space records, if you will, and maybe even some electrical car talk in just a minute. Stay with us here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxel, and the air with me is Ben Jaffe. Hey, on KOSP is also the 7th Avenue Project, and that's Sundays. And here's a little bit about tomorrow's. Will success spoil Maria Bamford? After years of being a comedian's comedian, Maria Bamford is now getting wider acclaim for her frank and funny explorations of mental illness and recovery. She talks to Robert Pauly about her life, her love of pugs, going to 12-step programs, and how she's handling her newfound fame. That's 7th Avenue Project, Sundays, here on KOSP. Mr. Jaffe, I cut you off in the middle of your Google stories. Your second one was kind of
fascinating. I never understood pugs.
Pugs?
Do you understand pugs?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're small dogs with squat faces that are cute.
I just don't think they're cute.
And big bottom lips.
I feel bad. I just don't think they're cute.
All right.
I don't know. Whatever. Maybe I'm just not a pug person. There's a second half to this. Well, not a second half, but another Google story that is relatively recent. So have you heard of USB security keys?
Sure.
Of course you have.
But so, not everybody. Please do tell.
Have you heard of two-factor authentication?
Yes, we've talked
about
it a lot.
One of our favorite topics. So,
the idea is a password something you know and a physical object something you have. So that physical object can participate in authentication, then you have two-factor, something you know and something you have.
I want to know that you're you, so I can ask you for a password. But, you know, Joe Schmo could steal your password or guess your password.
Yeah.
I could also authenticate with something that your phone knows.
Mm-hmm.
And by having the phone, you know, that works out. Well, the USB security keys are pretty cool. They are basically little USB keys that you can plug into your computer. And when you're logging in, you tap the key and then it interacts with the page and shows that you are you. So this is not a remote login. This isn't, you know, someone logging in with your password from a computer that's not yours, from somewhere that doesn't have that security key. By tapping it, you're basically saying, yeah, I've got the security key, here it is.
It's very similar to the old secure IDs, those little codes we used to carry in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
That had a numeric value that changed every minute, and you'd have to enter that value to prove that you had that object.
Well, that's
two-factor authentication,
like,
as well.
Google Authenticator.
This is the same
that.
Thing. The USB fob actually has a counter like that, and as you tap it, it just does that same thing.
It does that automatically.
Yeah.
So instead of typing in a 6-digit number, you're just tapping a button and it does it for you.
Now, this hasn't been available until recently, which is awesome, except it has been available for employees of Google. I know this because Miles, who's one of the geeks, has this on his device. He showed, you know, tapped at one point. He's like, what are you tapping? He's like, that's my secure ID. I'm like, well, I want one of those. He's like,
right.
I work for Google.
Did you get one?
I'm like, thanks. No, because I didn't know you could actually do it. Now you can.
Now you can.
Well.
So cool. Actually, just to put an image in your head, if you have seen a USB port that has a weird, like almost like a little
metal loop
coming out, not very far, just barely protruding. That metal loop that indicates, oh yeah, there's actually a teeny little USB key, security key inside of the actual USB port. It's not something that sticks out of your computer very far,
right.
So you could literally plug it in and just have it plugged in.
Have it all
the time.
Just takes a port. Of course, you can plug it whenever you want to. And then by just tapping it, when you tap it, that voltage differential, it detects, and then it sends that code into your machine.
Yeah, it's pretty smart. Pretty
awesome.
I need more USB ports on my computer.
Yeah,
right?
All the geeks do.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the same way.
Yeah, maybe I'll get a Windows machine.
So Tesla is a California car company that's producing electric cars, and they've got a kind of a high-end cars right now. They're pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Pretty cool too. For being in here in Silicon Valley, it's easy to swing by and take a look at them and see them on display at Santana Row. I think they've got a shop, but they don't have those shops are actually Tesla owned spaces. They have no distribution system like a normal car company, where you have the car company, you have a sales company in the middle, and then as a customer, you only deal with the sales entity, and then the sales entity takes a cut, tries to sell you a car, and then deals with the manufacturer.
Right. The sales entity is a buffer.
Yeah.
In between the company, so the company can just keep doing what it does.
That's the idea of it, I guess. But basically, you know, early on, the way the car industry worked in the U.S. is that these companies, you'd create a franchise, and you'd be a franchise of that, and you'd be a dealer of that franchise, right? So the dealer industry became this really big thing. Well, Tesla doesn't want to do that at all. They want to do direct sales. One reason to do that, of course, is to reduce the cost of their vehicles. They're trying to make these vehicles that have a lot of new technology, a lot of development, as cheap as possible, because they want them to be mass-produced vehicles.
So no middleman means no cut, means a cheaper price for their
cars. That's the idea. And you can actually buy a Tesla on their through their website, right? You don't need to go into a store. You can't do this with someone like Honda or any of the other companies.
How crazy. You can buy a car online.
Yeah. So what's unfortunate is that even though it's possible to buy directly from them, states have been outlawing the ability to buy directly, which is kind of horrible. Yes.
Wait,
so,
why?
So far, in Texas, Arizona, New Jersey, and Maryland, it is illegal to sell directly. You have to have a distributor in the middle.
What is the dealer. What is the rationale for that?
Well,
what could be any possible reason why that's a good
Catherine Rampel has a great article at the Washington Post about this. I'll link to it from the website. Talking about her opinion of this, of course, you don't really know the motivations of the senators and such, but the only reason why this would take place from her perspective, there's two potential reasons. Mm-hmm. The only real reason to do this is that the political figures make a lot of money from dealerships. So dealerships don't want to be taken out of the loop.
God, I was hoping you were going to give me a real good reason.
There basically isn't one. If you'd like to read that whole story and kind of get a consumption of that, it'd be great. The real reason I covered the story, though, is because I didn't buy a Tesla this week. But I did buy a Nissan Leaf. And I've been driving an electric vehicle. That was my surprise for you, Ben. I want to talk about that.
We didn't talk about this before.
So,
how do you like it, first of all?
Okay, I've had it since Sunday, and I'm in love with it. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure I was going to buy an electric vehicle. I knew a lot about them because I've got friends who have them, and they're raving about them.
This is day six of your Leaf.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a brand new 2015 vehicle. Kind of top of the line, right? So it's kind of an expensive package.
Have you gone on more drives because you have this car that you want to play with?
I'm definitely, any kind of short drives, I'm trying to use that vehicle. Mm-hmm. I mean,
what's the range?
Yeah, so the range of it's about 85 miles.
Okay.
And that's on one charge. And
so
you can plug it into
San Jose and back easy.
Yeah, I've done that a few times, actually. I worked a lot in San Jose and Santa Ana Row this weekend. And actually, I was getting home and still having, you know, quite a bit of mileage to go. So, the range is interesting. There's also a lot of plug-in places of this, including downtown Santa Cruz. Throughout until January, all their charging stations are free. You can just drive up and plug.
Wow.
It's free parking and free electricity for your vehicle, which is kind of cool. They are ending that, unfortunately, in January.
How much is that going to cost?
Well, so normally the charge points that you have to actually pay money on are about 50 cents per kilowatt hour.
Turn that into miles for me.
Yeah, so I'm averaging right now in my vehicle about 4 miles per kilowatt hour.
4 miles per kilowatt hour. Okay, so that's 50 cents per 4 miles.
Yeah.
So that's like 12 cents, 12 and a half cents a mile.
Something like that. I think that, not 12 and a half. Yeah, something like that. I don't need to do the math. But my point is, yes, that's right. But at home, the electrical rate here is about 19 cents per kilowatt hour, so cheaper to charge from home. And this vehicle does plug in through a normal plug, you know, a normal 120 outlet. You can charge the vehicle slowly. It takes quite a while time to charge. You can also hook up a 240 outlet.
I was going to ask about
that. And it's a lot faster to charge. And then those are the charge points that are kind of around. There's also a few charge points that do a rapid charge that can charge the vehicle completely in 2 hours, though those can, if you use those regularly, those will degrade the performance of your battery over time.
Got it. So just on a need to.
So any other questions about electric vehicles? I figure I kind of have one now. I'm into it. It has a boot up sound, which is kind of fun.
When
you start the car, it's like there's a few different tones you can choose.
Good, you can choose. I was imagining Windows 98 boot up.
The one
sound.
Thing that's frustrating to me about this, and this is always frustrating when you're a geek and you program, you look at what they have to offer, and there's just these shortcomings that are so frustrating.
Okay, tell me about those.
All right, so there's three screens in the car that have display information. Right, one's a full LCD with navigation system and all that, but I can't modify that screen. Right, it is a closed API. Even though it's a full screen, I could write code for it. I know I could, but No.
It is what it is.
It is what
no
it is.
Touching.
Good luck on that. Exactly. It also
get used to it.
It also has a data plan, right? The car actually has a cell phone service, so it's
Whoa,
always it's phoning
really?
Home and keeping track of things. Yeah. And it's used for the navigation information, what charging stations are available and currently open in your area, things of that nature.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Being tracked all the time?
Yeah.
I have a cell phone in the United States. I'm tracked all the time anyway, so it doesn't
okay,
matter
so
to me.
So it's just one more company?
Just another company know what I already know. Yeah. So I'm not real concerned about that, but it is kind of creepy. You can turn it off, of course, and you just get less features. But one of the features you get with that is you can leave the vehicle and run the smartphone app and check on the vehicle if it's what its charging status is. You can turn on the heater remotely.
How are you feeling? Are you lonely? Should I come back?
Yeah, exactly. It does that kind of thing, exactly. But, you know, the communication protocol to do any of the interface with the car is completely locked around this stupid app they've written that hasn't gotten better. In fact, the app that they have that's actually better is a marketing app they have that if you want to buy one of these vehicles, use this app and we'll calculate and figure things out for you. That app has better features than the one I'm currently using
no.
to manage my car. Exactly.
Oh, God, that's so depressing.
Yeah. There is a pretty good community forum around the vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And some people have, you know, broken into the firmware, hacked things, backwards engineered the API that the apps use.
Yeah.
So there is some hacking, including someone that wrote a Google Glass app that allows you to read your charge levels and
of
stuff.
Of course
which I'm
did.
Sure I'll run a Node service to run that as well. That'd be fun.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
That's
so
intense.
The thing that's great about the car that you don't really get until you start thinking about getting one of these vehicles, it doesn't have oil changes. It doesn't have filter changes. You have to change the coolant, and you have to deal with the brakes and the tires. That's the maintenance.
Wow.
Yeah. So you know when you open a hood and you're like, wow, there's a lot of reservoirs of liquids of some sorts. Yeah, not so much in this vehicle. It's kind of cool.
I have to get my oil changed, and I'm very busy this weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's kind of
and
a drag.
And of course, I don't stop at gas stations, ever. That just doesn't happen.
Because your house is a gas
station. I just
station,
charge at home. Yeah, just like, you know how you plug your phone in at night? I plug my car in at night.
Yeah. Oh.
It's pretty cool.
It's like tucking it in at night.
Exactly.
I find myself wanting to anthropomorphize it a lot. do you find that?
No.
It's
no.
just a car.
I had to name it, and it's red, so I named it Ruby, but no, I don't.
You had to name it?
One of the reasons I didn't do the lease and I did the purchase is, as my wife said to me, you know, Lyle, you're not very kind to vehicles. And it's mostly because I don't care about vehicles. I care about people. I'm not, utility is important to me in equipment and technology. It's not about how shiny it is or any of those things.
Uh-huh.
So dings and dents and dirt, I don't see as much. It's something I have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
So we bought instead of lease because I probably wouldn't be very good at taking care of the vehicle. But I would say I'm definitely taking care of this vehicle more than I ever have another vehicle because it feels so good to be driving it. It's got good up. And by the way, it slowed my driving because the entire time it's giving you feedback on how well you're doing, how much
the
mileage you have.
Yeah.
It gives you feedback. And one of the things that you don't want to do is fast deceleration, and just speedy in general. The slower you go, the better, basically.
Wow.
And so I've been being a little more slow and doing a lot of pulling over and getting back on the road, which has always been my pattern. But in any case, electric vehicles, pretty cool. I'm excited them to grow. I think it's a great technology.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I looked up some stats on this car. Even with the battery pack and the building and the new technology in the vehicle, it still has a lower build footprint if you give it a life of 5 years than any other car in the United States that has a four passenger. That's the recent test that it won. Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So can you explain what that means, Ben?
Well, I mean, so building things, you have an environmental footprint associated with it, right? So the energy that goes into it, the resources, the actual physical resources that go into it. So all of those steps carry with them different footprints. So for example, corrosive battery chemicals,
like the lithium ion battery. Yep.
Yeah. Carry with them a very negative environmental footprint, both in producing and also in disposal, and then, I mean, same goes for traditional cars and all of the various oil and whatnot.
Yeah. And so if you take...
And batteries are pretty bad to
also, as
produce.
Also, as you mass produce, as you get larger and produce more and more vehicles, like a Honda Civic or something that just has a giant scale, the footprint actually decreases most of the time per mm-hmm. vehicle because you get to do efficiencies. And so if you're booting up a new car, like Tesla, for example, they actually have quite a bit of cost associated with all of their vehicles. And it's one of the things they want to reduce. But that's environmental cost as well as actual physical cost.
Yeah. Wow. So do you want to go to the Swanton Berry Farm after the show?
Sounds good.
I just want to ride in your car.
Yeah, we'll definitely drive your car. You can give a report later. Let's go on with other news, shall we?
Yeah.
I think what we were about to talk about, and I'm hoping, what I would like to talk about is some Well, okay, so a week, 2 weeks ago, we talked about coding, and we ran off the end of the show, I think it was last week, about crazy, crazy coding stuff. And it was stuff that you and I would understand, but nobody else would, and I love that aspect. Can you do some more coding stuff for me?
Are you referring to how to write unmaintainable code?
Yeah, first you explain what
so I means. So for my work, I'm actually doing some research in for a class that I'm actually putting together. So I came across a bunch of blog posts and articles about how to write maintainable code, and I also came across this one, how to write unmaintainable code. And this is a really long document with all of the best practices of how to write unmaintainable code.
Oh, God. Read a couple.
So I'm just going to read a couple things.
Wait, let me give an understanding to everybody what that means.
Okay, well, yeah.
Yeah?
I've got a good metaphor.
Please.
All right, so let's say you want to build a wood structure. So you get some nails and you get a hammer, and you've never done this before, but you've got a hammer, you've got some nails, you kind of throw things together, you hammer wood and nails into wood and connect things, and you've got a structure. And I mean, it looks pretty. It may not be good enough to stand on, right? And so then you buy a drill gun and some screws and everything, and you buy better tools and a saw, and you build something like that. And it's definitely better built. But what you're really lacking is the organizational, the how do I build this app?
Yeah.
Not the what are my tools, not or what are the features of the language, but how do I architect this application, whether it's an Android app or iPhone app or web app,
mm-hmm.
or an app for your computer. How do I build this in such a way that all of the moving pieces are not directly connected to each other? They're as we say in programming, separation of concerns. That way, if you want to add things, you can just add them to these individual pieces. You don't have spaghetti code.
And there's some opposite aspects of maintainability. If you use that same metaphor of the wooden structure, a good construction person that understands the rules of building a house, you frame a door a certain way. Mm-hmm. So if you ever want to replace that door, it's actually easy to do that, right?
Yeah, because all the doors in the world are the same, basically.
Roughly. But there is some aspect you can plug
there
it in. But I mean,
practices.
If you were to, mount a slightly smaller door, but you put it in a frame that was slightly smaller, and you had to modify the house to change the size of the door, that'd be really bad. So normally doorways actually have a bit of give, right? You have a little bit of spacing in there that has to do with the framing that makes it easier to potentially later change the door. And it's not something you would do automatically. You do it because of experience about maintainability of structures and things. But in any case, so what are some examples of bad maintainability?
Well, actually, I've got one more thing I just want to say, which is that a lot of times you'll have the person who builds the app, and then you'll have the maintenance programmer who comes in after while your programmers are off building something else, and just their job is just to fix little bugs, to maintain the code, to make sure everything continues working. So here, I just want to read the first three paragraphs of this. General principles. To foil the maintenance programmer, you have to understand how he thinks. He has your giant program. He has no time to read it all, much less understand it. He wants to rapidly find the place to make his change, make it, and get out, and have no unexpected side effects from the change. He views your code through a toilet paper tube. He can only see a tiny piece of your program at once, and you want to make sure he can never get at the big picture from doing that. You want to make it as hard as possible for him to find the code he's looking for. But even more important, you want to make it as awkward as possible for him to safely ignore anything.
Nice.
Lastly, programmers are lulled into complacency by conventions. But every once in a while, by subtly violating convention, you force him to read every line of your code with a magnifying glass. And then
these are all examples of really bad maintainability
code. That's the introduction.
Yeah.
Here are just two examples. This is just under the naming section, the very first section. New uses for names for baby. Buy a copy of a baby naming book and you'll never be at a loss for variable names. Fred is a wonderful name and easy to type. If you're looking for easy-to-type variable names, try ASDF or QWE.
Which, of course, the keys below your fingers in resting position on a keyboard.
Exactly.
So
if you call your variables A, B, and C, then it will be impossible to search for instances of them using a simple text editor. Further, nobody will be able to guess what they're for. If anyone even hints at breaking the tradition honored since Fortran of using I, J, and K for indexing variables, namely replacing them with II, JJ, and KK, warn them about what the Spanish Inquisition did to heretics. So it just goes
wonderful.
On and on.
It's wonderful. One of the, and of course, this is examples of exactly what not to do, but it's a great teething methodology. analogy, right? You kind of explain by example the wrong way.
Yeah, just like, don't do any of this.
Hey, so we should do some follow-up. We already had some feedback. One of them was that you were doing a story earlier, and there's the URL for it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the story was the one about the barometer, and there's pressurenet.io. And actually, that's just one example. There are a number of Android apps out there which will take your barometer readings and will send them off.
Cool, with location.
Yeah, to a place. And so, I mean, the guy who was the guy in the article was basically saying, like, we've got the sensors. Why can't we use them?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And of course, it's just the privacy issue and also the implementation. You got to convince someone with the power to do it.
Yeah. So pressurenet.io, and of course we'll have that up at geekspeak.org.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we'll find an Apple one too. If you know of an Apple barometer one for the new iPhone 6, let us know and we'll add it up
to
the list as well. Don also was listening to the show after us and wanted to know what actual electric vehicle was I talking about. I was talking about the Nissan Leaf. Now, of course, I purchased that, but I also don't like the idea of being representing what you should buy in technology. One of the things about nonprofit radio is that we're not commercials, right? So just my opinion, please research yourself. There are lots of EV choices. And of course, the longer you wait, the more choices you get.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to get a Fit, the Fit EV, but you can't get them because it's so difficult to get them.
Honda Fit?
Honda Fit, yeah.
I didn't know that was a...
Just had a great leasing option. And so I was kind of curious about it.
The Fit is also a
it's a normal gas power. Yeah. The body shell's relatively the same. The interior, of course, is very
interesting.
The engine drive, of course, is very different.
That probably was a crazy project to work on.
Yeah. So looking through, I wanted to mention something that's kind of sad. You use Twitter, right?
I do.
All right.
I mean, and, I do, like, I've tweeted 5 times.
And I think everyone knows what Twitter is at this point. Twitter actually didn't used to support images directly in Twitter.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so some of the products that were available would use a different service for uploading images, and one of the more common one was actually called TwitPic. And this would allow you to say, well, I'm going to take a photo, I'm going to upload it, and then if I use the right clients that can read the image will actually show up in my Twitter feed. Mm-hmm. So these images would just go to the service called TwitPic, and it didn't seem very disassociated with your Twitter feed. It felt like the same thing. You don't think about it much.
Yeah. But it's actually technically a completely different service, completely different people probably.
Yeah. Currently, there's about 800 million pictures that have been uploaded to TwitPic. So
what?
800 million. Yeah.
That's
a lot of pictures.
I mean, if that was bytes, I mean, that's just characters. But pictures are...
Yeah, a little bigger. Yeah, it's a lot of data. I mean, it's a bit of a problem. It's a lot of data. The company's going out of business, closing down and deleting all that. Well, not deleting all of it, just not making it accessible anymore. Except that you could, of course, get your access to your files if you wanted to by requesting them, except that that service hasn't gone very well. The long and the short of it, though, is that it's supposed to close today, which is unfortunate because I think I actually have pictures that I'm about to lose, and I rarely lose pictures. Because one of the things that some of those clients did early on Twitter is when you submitted the photo, there's no copy of it locally. So the traditional backup process that I think geeks do pretty well, but everybody should, doesn't have that image. That image only exists in that location. I don't think it really matters. At the same time, it's kind of sad. And there's this group that's been around for years. In fact, it's called the Archive Team. It's a collective started in 2009, right after Yahoo announced it was shutting down GeoCities. Remember GeoCities?
I do.
Yeah. These were websites.
That was a long time ago.
So this group basically started scraping all that content to try to save it, to archive it. They're in partnership with the Internet Archive, and they've got lots of examples of taking old sites that were closing down and trying to get stuff. Like in 2010, the archive team managed to grab 10 terabytes of data from Friendster, you know, before Facebook. Remember Friendster? They try
no,
to grab stuff.
I don't. I mean, I kind of do, but...
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding me. That was 2010.
I remember it. But...
So it's actually quite a bit of work to get this data off. Because when you're talking about that kind of data, it takes
huge,
a time to copy it, right?
Huge volume.
Yeah. So I don't know the final case of how much they're getting before it gets shut down, or if it maybe the people at TwitPic will actually delay their turn-off status somehow share it. The interesting thing about this kind of archiving concept, the reason why this group wants to do this is that they feel that part of our society heritage is the content we're creating.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you yeah. Know? So if you look at the early web and you look at Tripod.com and you look at GeoCities, that was the beginning of the internet.
Yeah.
That was the internet in its formative years.
Yeah.
And if that goes away, then we don't have that historical record.
And you know,
and it seems so strange too. It's not like a building has burned down and we lost some books. It's like this data, we can just copy it.
Right.
We just need to have a place to put it,
yeah,
and some people to manage it and make sure that it doesn't go away later accidentally when the hard drive fails.
And of course, the Internet Archive at archive.org has the mission of doing just that, of preserving the data flotsam that we create. And the thing is about the GeoCities and things of that nature going down is that, you know, if there's a shop that showed up that advertised they only were up on that site and they were up for a while and then that site goes away, normally there would have been a print catalog of this, right? There would be a newspaper. Somebody would have advertised in a newspaper and the newspaper archives. And one of the things libraries does is archives newspapers, right? So
yeah,
you
right.
do have a record. If you talk to any researchers that are curious about a certain period of time, newspapers is a major resource for that. But in the internet age where sites can go away and data gets destroyed, it's not exactly really easy to hold on to that information. So mm-mm. you have to have librarians motivated to do this. And of course, this archive collective is basically librarians, right? That's the yeah. goal of a library is to yeah. keep an archive and keep access to the archive. So I wish them well. I'll keep you informed of whether that 800 million photos were saved. And moving on, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
This is KSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak, and the airman with me is Ben Jaffe. One of the other things we got from Greg Markley in Canada is that we didn't talk about why those laws actually exist regarding dealers and car companies. And the reason they first were introduced was to protect dealers from car companies, right? As the car company gets large enough, it can open its own stores and therefore get rid of the dealerships. And so the dealerships protected, especially if they're located in certain areas that they have like a control over. That's the reason for the protection, is to protect the dealerships. I personally, after just buying a car, do not like dealerships. I hate the process. I hate the salespeople. You know, the whole process just feels gross to me. And I don't think I'm alone on that. I think I've bought, you know, two cars in the last year. And the process is just horrible. I hate it. And a big part of that is that they're trying to make money off of what I'm doing, right? And I support that to some degree. At the same time, it's a continual live stream going to you, a favorable perspective being pumped at you. And I just can't stand that. I'd much rather go to a place that's got prices set that you can buy things and the information is informative. And that just doesn't exist in dealer culture. So I'm happy Tesla's doing what they're doing.
How often do you buy a car? Not very often.
Not very often.
How often do they sell cars?
All the
time.
Very,
very often. So if I'm okay with the idea of bartering for the price of something, but only if both people are on even footing, and they almost never are, except when the used car dealership person goes to buy his own used car or her own used car. That's probably an interesting
Well, no, I mean, if you're more informed in that space, and the other thing is to be informed in a car space, you've got to be really informed. You've got to educate yourself a lot. And who wants to do that unless they're really involved in that space?
It's probably how a lot of people feel about technology.
Yeah, it's true.
It'd be nice to find a place to trust and then just trust them and, you know.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Let's go on to other stories, shall we, sir?
Yeah, we were talking about images. Yeah. I've got an image story. Have you heard of Snapchat?
Sure.
Speaking of social networks and images.
Snapchat, of course, is an instant chatting service that was kind of made popular by a more youthful community. It's extremely popular, and one of the ideas behind it is as you text and send pictures and video shorts, they theoretically are destroyed relatively quickly. So it's a moment in time but has no archive.
In theory, right?
In theory.
But anyway, that's not actually what my story is about. My story is about advertisements on Snapchat because we all knew it was coming.
Yes, I mean, they have to make money somehow.
Exactly. So they actually, just a couple days, actually last week, they announced plans to roll out their first advertisement. And they did that last weekend. And so what does that mean? Like how are ads shown in Snapchat? Well, what they're saying is they're going to put ads as if they're stories, but they're not going to look like they're coming from your friends. They will be labeled as ads. Mm-hmm. And you can choose to click on them and watch them, or you can choose to ignore them. If you ignore them, they'll go away within like 24 hours or something. How often will you get ads? From time to time. Mm-hmm. That's a quote. So it just raises an interesting question, a couple interesting questions for me. First of all, it seems that what they want is for people to choose to watch ads because they're out of snaps from their friends. And so, hey, I'll just continue my behavior of clicking on snaps and click on this snap ad.
Will the app still, when you have an ad, will it give you a badge to represent that you've got data to look at?
I don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But anyway, that's what they're doing. And
do you
it
Snapchat?
Also, Barely.
I don't like to connect with you on Snapchat.
With my mom, I think.
I barely use it as well.
It's fun. Actually, my whole family's on Snapchat. And for a while, we were snapping pictures from the zoo and whatever else. And I mainly just consumed. And yeah.
Okay, cool.
But we've kind of fallen off of it. I don't know. It's going to be also interesting to see how long Snapchat lives, because pretty much every service has a birth date and then eventually a death date. It'll just be interesting to see if this is like a next 10 years thing or if it's a couple years.
So a little while ago, a man by the name of Felix Baumgartner jumped really, really far, right? He fell from outer space basically in a suit. And I watched the video, and I think you showed me the video on GeekSpeak. I wish I remember where that was. But can you tell me an update to that?
'Cause I think it's fascinating. Yeah, there is now a new record.
And it's not the same person.
No, it's Alan Eustace, I think is
Isn't
how you pronounce it.
Isn't he a Google
person? He's a Google VP, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually an interesting story. I'm not going to tell the entire story, but it'll be up on geekspeak.org. But basically, he decided he wanted to do that. And I think he actually started planning before Felix's jump. And so he jumped from, like, I don't know, 5% higher or something like that.
Okay. We're talking about stratosphere jumps, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're talking about you are so high that you can see the layers of the atmosphere. You can very clearly see a huge curvature of the Earth. Like, you can see that the Earth is a big circle or a big sphere.
So how does it make a jump? Because, I mean, the vehicle they're in.
Question.
Yeah, when I saw the first jump, I saw the video of that and stuff.
He jumped out of a pod.
Yeah, the pod's actually like a rocket that takes him up. Is it a balloon?
No, it's a pod with a balloon attached.
Yeah,
and
balloon.
That's actually how.
And then
how
he has to jump out of the pod, but at the same time, the suit that he's wearing is immense. It's not like, yeah, I'm going to the grocery store. It's like a big.
He's not in jeans and a t-shirt.
No, because you've got to protect yourself from, like, I don't know, no atmosphere and burn and all of that stuff that's going to happen by falling. So when does a suit become a vehicle? You know. Anyway.
Oh, that now that's an interesting question.
But in any case, the same thing was done by 5% higher by Alan.
And
he didn't make a big deal about it.
No, he didn't. So a couple of the things. First of all, he didn't make a big deal about it. He's just like, yeah, I want to do this. I'm just going to do it. So he had a whole team of people. And, you know, also, Google actually offered to help financially with it and be a part of it. And he said, no, because he didn't want it to be a big publicity thing. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to do it, I think. So and he also broke the speed of sound, obviously. So there was a sonic boom. People on the ground actually heard his sonic boom. He didn't, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, right.
Because okay. When when that happens,
makes sense.
You don't. And
as everyone knows, I know that, but it makes sense, I guess.
I don't know. I'm sorry. But yeah, and actually, okay, cool. there's this picture of him landing with a parachute, and it really, honestly, it looks like a man in a space in like a moon suit.
Yeah. Well,
landing.
That's cool. So that's a suit. Yeah.
It's a suit. Yeah, it's a
awesome.
Real suit.
All right. So that's a great little stat about high diving. What about let's talk to you. And that was a Google story, kind of. And earlier you were talking about Apple stories. Got an Apple stat for me?
I'm sure I do. what Apple? I do have an Apple stat for you.
So can you tell that we're reading the same documents, everybody?
No, I'm not reading that document. The Apple One,
mm-hmm.
one of the first Apple computers, sold recently at an auction for $905,000.
That's a lot of money.
I wish I had an Apple One sitting in my
Did
basement.
You have an Apple One? Well, there weren't that many.
No, there were not.
No. I mean, the Apple One
funny
did
if
not.
There was only one.
The Apple One didn't have a case of any sort, I don't think. Right? The Apple II had the first case, or am I mistaken? I got to get pictures of the Apple.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture now, too. sorry, got me off guard. I do have a different story
mm-hmm.
also about Elo. Have you heard about Elo?
No, what's Elo?
It's a new social network.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've heard of it. I didn't get an invite. I didn't get a connection. I'm kind of upset about it.
I got
it
invited. I'm not super impressed right now. Probably that's one of the reasons it's an invite is because they're still building it. You know, like they're building it. God, I've thought about this
what
before.
What is it, first?
It's a social network. It must be so hard to build a social network from scratch because the only way it's interesting for people is if there are already people there.
Yes.
So it's really a chicken and egg problem. So anyway, it's basically their whole thing is we care about you, we care about your security, we care about your best interest, we're not going to share all that stuff.
Right.
So kind of a stab at Facebook.
Well, so there's another one of these a while ago called Alpha.net. Do you know that one?
I don't know that one.
Alpha.net is still running, and one of the things they said is we're going to charge for the service. It will be a four-charge service. It will never be advertising. You will own it. And Alpha.net's been going for a while. I recently downgraded my paid account. I made a paid account once just to get my handle on it, and I'm not going to pay for it again. No one went there, right? It's there, but it's not really functional. And is Elo going to win?
Or it's functional, but there's nobody there, so it isn't functional as a social network. Right, so even if it's technically there, it's not compelling. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens with Elo. But a couple things: they have become a public benefit corporation, and they have promised to remain ad free.
Yep.
And they have also raised $5.5 million. So good job.
Do you have any invites for it? If you have an invite, please send it my way.
Let me log in. I'll send it.
I'm Lyle at geekspeak.org. If anyone wants to send me invites, I'd like to be able to get on the service. All right, cool. Let's talk about Sync, shall we?
Sync, sure.
BitTorrent Sync, specifically.
BitTorrent Sync. Now,
I can tell you a little bit about it. It's kind of amazing.
Tell me about it.
So BitTorrent, of course, is this multi-user, multi-node sharing situation where we've talked about it before on GeekSpeak, but if I want to share a file to Ben and I just send him the file, I have to upload all of the data and he has to download all of the data
through one pipe.
Yeah, right between us. Well, we can do it. Yeah. Potentially, yeah, we'd have a server that we'd have to upload to and so on.
Now, if
in
you
a
want
BitTorrent
to
situation, yeah, in a BitTorrent situation, we've got Ben and Bonnie and Miles. I give a little bit of the file to Ben. At the same time, I give a little bit to Bonnie, a little bit to Miles. Then once all of them have it, they share with each other as well. So I only ever share one part of the file to every person, and they all share together, and therefore it goes faster. That's for file sharing. That's the basics of BitTorrent. BitTorrent Sync is the idea behind this is that you would have two different machines yourself, and you would use that same syncing cloud to share the files between each other. And it's a cool protocol.
Which is a strange concept.
Yeah, it's a strange concept.
Yeah.
It works as you have more nodes and as you share things, but one of the problems with it is that they haven't really clarified how the protocol really works, so we're not sure how secure it is. There's a bit of a concern there, but the performance, you've got an update on the performance of this.
Very, very good. So they recently they did a test and they just kind of showed off how fast it was in terms of transferring a 1.36 gigabyte MP4 video clip. It was way faster than Google Drive, OneDrive, and Dropbox. Like 8, 11, and 16 times faster.
So we might see the rise of this distributed syncing kind of thing.
That would be cool.
Hey, this is GeekSpeak. It's a registered service mark of David Lawrence, used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, online at kosp.org. And of course, everything we talk about is available at geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. Ben, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And that's Ben Jaffe. We'll be here next week. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening. And do stay tuned here on KOSP.